Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Peter Cooper, artist, illustrator, writer. His latest book is Insectopolis, A Natural History. And tonight we're going to talk about the whole length of Peter's career. Peter, welcome. It's a pleasure to talk to you once again. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to look back on your career, which is, it's funny. I've been reading your material for a long time, for decades now. And I realized that as I reviewed stuff from your website. And I want to mention your website is www.petercooper.com, Peter Cooper, one word. And people should go there while they're listening to this interview and you're talking about it. Now, talk to me about your beginnings, Peter. I'm always fascinated talking to an artist. Were you one of those kids that always drew, or were you on the route for a medical career and then had a fateful, like, you'd be surprised. It's like one of those two things. I was an artist. I always wanted to be an artist, and now I'm an artist. Yeah, the other thing is I'm going to be a piano expert. I had this one art teacher, and now I'm an artist.
I definitely had an art teacher that made things seem exciting, but it was really, I wanted to be an entomologist when I was a child. And then I went from, you know, looking at insects to looking at Spider-Man. And I know that's not an insect, but I just got very, comics really hit me, which didn't move insects out of my, perimeter. It just became an add-on, but comics got more and more important to me. And when I was 11, my friend and I went to our first comic book convention.
Oh, whoa.
Got to meet artists. We started doing a fanzine. I was barely drawing. I didn't, there was no indication that I was going to end up actually being able to draw, but the form was so fascinating to me. And I realized later that I really was just taking it in, and through osmosis, I had a lot of information in my head. So when I did start to apply myself, I had a fairly deep well to go into, to draw from for doing comics. But I was hugely lucky because of this, making a connection with comic conventions. Then I was able to meet artists, see what the career was like. I went up to the annual pilgrimage from Cleveland, which is where I grew up, was to New York for the big comic convention there. And with my mom and friend's dad chaperoning us. And we would, we could interview Jack Kirby.
Oh,
and,
God.
Bill Gaines from MAD. And, then meet all these artists. And I could see what that career could be before I was even anywhere near it. I started sketchbooking when I was about 15, and a lot of that was looking at underground comics as I kind of doubled up with still reading superheroes, but then starting to see underground comics and people like Robert Crumb in particular.
Mm.
And another really weird thing that happened was, incidentally, I met Harvey Pekar, who, if your audience has ever seen the movie American Splendor, knows it's this guy who he started publishing his own comic. But I met him before he was doing that, and he was a writer, and he'd get together with artists. And his newspaper boy saw that I had my weekly comics and said, "There's a guy over there who's got." I saw a comic on his table, and I went over and rang his doorbell. And he invited me up, and he was probably in his late 20s when I was 12, and he showed me a piece of art, Robert Crumb original art, and he showed me some of his 78 RPM record collection. And incidentally, Robert Crumb came through town, and incidentally, the person who owned my parents' house had left behind a bunch of 78 RPM records, and I made a trade with Crumb for an interview and artwork for my fanzine that I was doing with my friend Seth DeBachman. And I mentioned Seth's name because he and I both ended up moving to New York, both remained interested in comics, both ended up at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn and started a magazine called World War III Illustrated when we were finding it very difficult to get our work published anywhere, since we were trying to do political kind of underground, very left-wing comics talking about Ronald Reagan coming into power. And
I still have my old issues.
The bomb and things like that.
I still have my old issues. That was a great zine.
And it still is. The new issue just came out. We've been doing it for 47 years, and he and I are both still involved. I'm co-editing the new issue, and I worked on the last one. And there's probably 30 or 40 people on any given issue. And anyway, it's hard to wrap up how this all occurred. One of the secrets to our ongoing success with the magazine is that nobody's ever been paid, so we've never had any money to fight over. And everybody just is doing it because they feel like they want to talk about these issues, and they like comics as a form to talk about what's going on, and we certainly have a lot to talk about right now.
The amazing thing is the Enterprise is so counterculture still.
It's really, you know, having alternative media like that is hugely important. And it was very important, you know, in the beginning of my career, because I was starting we did the first issue in 1979.
Right.
And that was right when underground comics had collapsed as a whole. It used to be very popular. You'd be able to, you know, if somebody published an issue of a comic, they would sell like 100,000 copies. It was just like there's a lot of interest in it. And then the distribution platform, which in many cases was head shops and record stores, disappeared, and it just sort of petered out. And so we were arriving into what I was hoping to be my career move right when it was disappearing.
Good move.
So yeah, you know that there's always that generational thing.
Yeah, but
I felt like I was always missing some great, you know, there was like a movement or something. I mean, I missed the Summer of Love. I was too young for that. The Beat Generation was years before, and we kind of, I guess, sort of vaguely thought like, you know, we're going to have to start this ourselves if we're going to have some kind of artistic, you know, scene like that. And it has actually worked out, because there's a number of artists that connected with the magazine that we became kind of a collective, that we had that back and forth, and the kinds of things I'd always read about that the Beats had and different musical periods had. And we have sort of found that through the magazine.
But I have, unlike Underground Comics, which I still have my old collection of that too, I find World War III to be more organized, and because there's a lot of different artists in every issue, that's very unlike the Underground Comics, which usually at the most featured two or three artists in an issue.
Unless it was like Zap Comics had.
Oh, right, and then they would actually have those where they all contributed to one strip. The fact that you met Crumb and Harvey Pekar was just amazing. I mean,
child too.
Oh my God!
One of the amazing moments was when Crumb was going to do the cover. I went over again. I was like, say, 13, and I went over to Harvey's because Crumb was visiting, and he was going to do the cover and trade for these 78 RPM records that I happened to have found in my parents' basement. And I sat down on the couch. He had not started doing the drawing yet, and I feared that if I left, he wouldn't do it. So I just sat on the couch staring at him and said, you know, like, I'll wait for you to finish the cover for our fanzine.
Good move.
And after about a half an hour of me staring at him, he gave me his sketchbook to look at just to distract me. And it was, you know, like a cosmic moment for going through this remarkable sketchbook. And then, crazily, he let me borrow it overnight. I rode off on my bike
You
know, became like a, I don't know, a $450,000 value.
Well, they've published those sketchbooks.
Photocopy it.
His sketchbooks have been published as entities unto themselves.
Exactly. And now, you know, I just went to the Whitney Museum, and there are pages from his, there's Crumb art in the Whitney current exhibition. So the other thing is I was connecting with the comics world in general, and when I moved to New York when I was 18, 1977, and I had very few skills. I used my sketchbook as a means of showing what I could do, and I went around to animation houses because I thought, well, at least, you know, I can paint blue backgrounds. I can do something. And, you know, with minimal skill. And one of the animation houses offered me a job, and I moved to New York for the job. And then I reached out to the guy. It was Xander Animation. They were doing Raggedy Ann and Andy.
Oh,
and by the time I got there, the film was finished, and the guy was like, couldn't remember who I was, and said, oh, yeah, sorry, animation's in a downward turn, and we don't have any work, sorry. But I was in New York, so I ended up staying. And I was at a comic convention, and I bumped into what had once been a fan artist, a guy named Howard Chaykin, who did the first Star Wars comic.
Yep.
And he just really randomly, I was like, hey, I've moved to New York. He said, hey, do you want a job? I need an assistant. And I started by filing, you know, clip art for him, and eventually started doing some coloring. And in the studio were several different artists, and among them, during my time in there, was Frank Miller, who ended up doing Dark Knight, and
he
was doing, you know, all sorts. Anyway, I'm nerding out a bit here.
No, yeah, that's fine with me, because I'm a nerd. Fan,
I'm a comic fan aware, then this has maybe less value, but so I had a little intro to, I was working, you know, getting my chops together that way. I also noticed on the newsstand that Harvey Comics, that's Richie Rich and Casper the Friendly Ghost, were based in New York. So I went to their offices and asked if I could try out to be an inker. I figured that was
nice.
Something I might be able to do to get my skills up. And they gave me photocopies to ink of Richie Rich. And I took them home and inked for a month, brought them back. They said, that's kind of okay. And then gave me more. And I went and inked samples for another month. And I got a job. And it took me a day and a half to ink my first page, and it paid $8. So it didn't look like it was going to be a great career move, but I did that for a year and a half, and slowly made my way up to.
Did you only work on Richie Rich? You didn't do like
Baby Huey
or anything, or Casper?
Yeah, only Richie Rich. But I mean, it's great irony that political cartoonist ends up inking Richie Rich.
Well, I always believed in the theory that Casper was the ghost of Richie Rich.
Right, of course. They're all sort of, you know, slightly cookie cutter of each other.
Hot stuff was their best skill set.
I needed to be working, drawing all the time to catch up with my lack of skills. And I was like in a work studies program. So I was doing inking Richie Rich, working in this studio for Howard Chaykin, and going to art school part time. And so I just was, you know, drawing. Jeez. You know, as 7 days a week, and that helped move things along in getting some skills.
I'm so glad I've actually talked to somebody who inked in Richie Rich. Can you imagine that comic existing today? Does it still exist?
Well, you know, yes.
There are people who would be burning issues.
That's true. Yeah. Well, but he was the good billionaire.
Right. Right. Yeah, just like the Clampets were good too. I got to talk to you about Spy versus Spy and working at Mad Magazine. You know, you talked about meeting Bill Gaines. You took over from Antonio Perhias, or I've never known how to pronounce his last name.
Perhias.
In 1997, and to me, when I realized that, it's an awesome responsibility to take over such a long-running, influential strip.
That was another dumb luck moment for me, because I had, for the first maybe decade of my career, doing comics was really almost as a hobbyist, because you know, we were self-publishing it. I could get a few things published with very little pay until about the early 90s, and I pitched an idea to DC Vertigo, which was a book called The System. And it was only because there was an editor who had been at five different magazines, real small magazines that I had been friends with, and he got a job there. And he asked me if I had any ideas. And I had this percolating idea for a book called The System. And I wanted to do it in a way that was completely outside of the superhero form. I mean, it was for DC, so there was, you know, Batman, Superman, although Vertigo had Sandman and a lot of other comics that were a little more alternative. So I said I was going to do it in stencils and spray paint. And so I had finished that book when Matt asked me to try out for Spy vs. Spy. And I almost turned them down on the spot because I was like, that's somebody else's characters. Although I grew up on it, it's kind of outside of, you know, I mean, I'm starting to do my own thing, and why would I want to try to mimic somebody else's style? So I did it in my sample in stencils and spray paint, and I just figured that'd be it. They'd look at that and go, no, thank you. I just thought if I was going to do it, I had to do it in a style that was really clearly my own thing.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be exactly the way to get the job, because they didn't want just a continuation of the same look. And I realized when I started working on it that it was really in my DNA. And in fact, the system I had done as a wordless book, pretty much. And so it was really, I noted that it was Spy versus Spy and maybe Sergio Aragonés's wordless things. And then a few other artists like Franz Masurile, who was like a 1915 woodcut artist, and Lynd Ward,
right,
who had done a book called God's Man in like 1929. These woodcut early sort of graphic novels, not exactly, but can be considered that. And they had been a big influence on me, and along with Spy versus Spy. And so doing a wordless strip was actually so fitting. And I'm continuing to do that, by the way. My next book is called Wish We Weren't Here, and it's a series of four-panel strips on environmental subject matter that I've been doing for Charlie Hebdo, the French political magazine, for the last 5 years. And it's collecting some of those years' worth of work right up to now. And it seemed like a rather urgent time to be talking about climate change when it's being basically erased as even a term that you can use. But the wordless aspect of it, which dovetails with Spy versus Spy, and which, by the way, I'm still doing. Everybody keeps thinking that Mad died, but it's actually, you know, kind of crawling along like the undead, and it manages to keep on coming out with issues. And they, I've been sort of re-upping it. They asked me to start in again. There was a little dip where I didn't do it for about a year or two, and then I'm now back doing it every issue, which is every other month.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Peter Cooper, artist, illustrator, writer. His latest book is Insectopolis, A Natural History, which is just stunning. But we've been talking about his long and varied career. Peter, I want to talk to you about developing that style, because you have one of those styles that you instantly recognize as yours. I especially think about that spray paint stencil look to it, but there's a lot of other aspects, the way you draw people in profile, the way you use profiles. How long did it take you to develop, to evolve that style? You didn't draw like that from the very beginning, did you?
No, it is an evolution. And one of the things that helped break me out of bad cartooning habits from just all the things I looked at was doing linoleum prints. When I was in art school, I started doing that.
Yep.
And that it was pretty laborious, but I found I got very fortunate again. I with comics not being a terribly viable career when I started out, I saw the illustration world as being an option. And it happened to be that my style and my sensibilities were, I really enjoyed doing these very quick turnaround, heavy duty newspaper deadlines and things like that. And I took my work to the New York Times right when I was coming out of art school and started getting regular work there. And linoleum prints print beautifully. It's very graphic, and it takes away certain stylistic things that comics, the kind of traditional incline that I had at least, were a little more club footy, and that it made it much more artistic, and it helped me work on my conceptual ideas too. And in general, I've been very uneasy with one style. I just can't seem to stick to one thing, and that was a little detrimental in my illustration career, in my early career, because I was sort of all over the place. I wanted to try collage and watercolor and linoleum prints and then pen and ink lines. And what I slowly but surely, as I developed my style, it was less thinking about it in terms of style and more about the way the thinking in the work. And so now I'm fairly free from consideration of which style, you know, having a style, and much more about that it's the ideas that drive it. And so if I do an adaptation of Kafka,
yeah,
say, which I've done The Metamorphosis and a collection of 14 stories in Kafkaesque, doing that in something like linoleum or woodcut, which I was using something called scratchboard, which is a chalk-covered paper, you can scratch away at to approximate a sort of woodcut flavor that was like German Expressionism, which seemed appropriate for Kafka. But when I adapted Heart of Darkness, then it has a much more sketchbook-like quality, which seemed appropriate for the material. So I really want, you know, the play is the thing. I want the story to drive what's an appropriate style for that. And when I did something of my own, say like The System, it's about a gritty period of New York that was sort of felt very graffiti-like to me. And the stencil work was something that my friend Seth Bachman had been doing, and I had done some with him. We'd like collaborated on a few things, and it had the qualities that I loved in art where you didn't know what you're going to get almost until the last moment. So when you spray, there's a lot of randomness to it. I never used airbrush. I always used highly toxic enamel paint and cutting stencils. And I just thought that the surprise element of it, when you lift the paper, that's what then you see where you're going to get. You don't really know what it's going to be exactly until that moment. And the same thing was true with linoleum, which is you carve this linoleum or wood, and then when you print it, it reverses, and then you peel it up, and the ink doesn't get down normally. And I loved that surprise element, and I love that having that in work, and I try to keep that as part of what I do, is just have it be surprising, and so that you're very energized. But then with a book like Insectopolis, I really needed it to be very accurate in its portrayal of insects, because it's this history of insects. I knew that entomologists would be looking at it, and I did not want to fail in capturing the right intonation on dragonfly wings. And the environment that I placed the insects in was the New York Public Library, because I had a fellowship there to work on the book, and I needed a lot of photo reference to capture all that architecture. And so that was a huge stylistic shift too, but I felt like the ideas were clearly coming from one vision, and that's what I'm interested in, not in, you know, I teach and I say to students, you know, styles I think of as being like clothing, that if you wear it too long, it starts to smell, and it's constantly changing. And, you know, bell bottoms worked at one point in my life, and they're not working for me right now, but, you know, that's okay.
It makes total sense to me. I did go through bell bottoms too. There's so much we could talk about. Oh, can you just talk about, we have minutes left, Walter Kurtz?
Walter, one of my alter egos. It was an idea I had to do an autobiography, but I wanted to move it over because I was changing my own story, and I thought it would be, you know, what was it, that million pieces? There was that book that this guy wrote that was supposed to be autobiographical, and turned out it was fiction. I think he was.
Oh, was that the one from Oprah?
Yeah, and he got in trouble for that. And I thought, you know, I'm changing the story around. I'm making myself, you know, a cartoonist who has a studio in the Chrysler Building, and at least in my fantasies, and that I'm working on a book, which is the book you're reading. I had this all meta ideas, and also, it was coming out of a book I had done called Stripped, that was a collection of autobiographical stories about losing my virginity and various drug use. Another alleyway I went down in writing where I was really interested in, like, bringing back the Robert Crumb part of my mentality. And HBO optioned that, and I worked on an animated show for a year and a half with them and got very far. And so I was, like, not sure that I wanted to have it be me as the character, and so I was playing with that. But I later realized that people kept on doubting a lot of true stories and going, is that really you? Did that really happen? And so it got that same book, Stop Forgetting to Remember, as it was the title, got translated in French and Spanish, and I had them change it back to being my name, and then it cut out that question of, are these true stories? Because it really, generally were, and I just was playing around with it, and people just preferred to say, that's you, right? And so anyway.
The obit for Walter Kurtz reads, among other things, his heart belonged to cartoons till the end.
That's a good obituary, yes.
It's excellent. It's excellent. It's got to go on your gravestone.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. There's so much we can talk
about. My life's an open comic book.
We don't have time, but I wanted to talk to you about your political caricatures, which are devastating. You have one of Mitch McConnell as, well, it's not really the Swamp Thing. It's more like the Heap from the old Mad magazine and Sarah Huckabee. You do a mean caricature. And I mean that in all senses of the word, too.
Yeah, it's my way of trying to come up with solutions, or at least, you know, attack the problems in some way that make... I know I feel better after I
feel better just looking at it. So we're a couple...
I'm hoping that's the case. It's really important at this incredible juncture.
Oh, no,
really
don't get started. Don't get started, because we'll be here for another hour.
I know. Yes.
My returning guest tonight is Peter Cooper, artist, illustrator, writer. His latest book is Insectopolis, A Natural History. He's got another new book coming out, which we're going to cover. But please go to his website, www.petercooper.com, to see the examples of what we're talking. Peter, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much once again.
You are listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.